In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about one of the world's most beautiful and mysterious objects, the Hope Diamond. Not the world's largest diamond, but one of its most beautiful and one of its most intriguing. My guest is Richard Curran, who is the Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian, where the Hope Diamond is housed. He has written several other interesting books, including The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects and Reflections of a Cultural Broker, A View from the Smithsonian. This book we'll be talking about today, published by the Smithsonian, is called The Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem. Explain to our listeners why someone at the Smithsonian is writing an extensive history of the Hope Diamond.
Well, because the Hope Diamond, interestingly enough, is, of course, at the Smithsonian. It's the center of our national gem collection. It has a very special place, and it is the most visited object in any museum on the planet.
Really?
Some 4 million to 5 million people every year come to the museum to look at that diamond. And, of course, when it was acquired in 1958, donated to the Smithsonian by famed diamond merchant Harry Winston, many Americans wrote to the Smithsonian and said, don't take it, this diamond is cursed, and if the U.S. takes it, then our country will be cursed. So I found it very fascinating to work here.
Absolutely. We're talking about a beautiful diamond, but also one which is maybe a little smaller than people might imagine. I think someplace in the book you liken it to the size of a walnut.
And it's a good-sized walnut, a thick walnut.
Right. Well, and that's a good-sized diamond. But, I mean, compared, for instance, to the picture on the cover of your book, we're not talking about something that's quite as huge as that.
No, in fact, when, you know, we interview people that come to the Smithsonian and before they've seen the Hope Diamond, they kind of think it's the size of about a softball.
Right.
And then they think it's about the size of a baseball sometimes. You know, it's surprising, again, how small it is given its reputation, its fame, and infamy. But, indeed, a 45.5-carat diamond is a pretty big chunk of stone.
Hmm. One of the things you've done here is done to the best of your ability or anyone's ability to trace, in effect, the factual history of the Hope Diamond, but along with it trying to trace the roots of this really extraordinary legend which has sprung up around it, the story of the curse of the Hope Diamond. And really, we get the sense that that the story of that curse is a relatively recent phenomenon from maybe about 100 years ago or so.
Well, that's true. And, you know, what I try to do in the book is really look at this object because it is traceable over, you know, about a 350-year history. As it moves across the planet from India to France to England to the United States. And so it's almost like a biography of an object that's lived for a long time and touched, you know, everybody from Marie Antoinette to various first ladies of the United States getting involved to being implicated with, you know, jewelers and national collections and so on. So it has a very, very rich biography. But the curse, as told, really comes along at the beginning of the 1900s, very relatively late in its biography, but it does take hold, and it's immediately attributed an ancient origin, but it was really used as a ploy by Cartier, the jewelers Cartier, to sell the diamond to a very wealthy American at the turn of the the 20th century, early 1900s.
Hmm. You describe that transaction where the Hope Diamond was unveiled for this wealthy woman, and that initial transaction didn't really take hold, but I guess eventually it did. But you talk about how the tale that Cartier spun about the Hope Diamond and of the misfortune which had befallen so many who had owned it. You said Cartier's tale had all the characteristics of a legend. Mm-hmm. It was regarded as a long-lived tale, widely known and passed down over time. It purported to be factual, but self-referentially admitted that some of those facts might seem fantastic and even fictional. Given the personalities, it was endowed with special significance. Indeed, it became instant folklore. early in the era of modern mass communication. What a fascinating concept, that of instant folklore. I mean, it's a contradiction in terms, of course, and yet here it is.
Yeah, well, I think you can look at other kinds of things of the era. You know, Cartier told the story of how it had been stolen from the eye of an idol in, of India, brought back to the West, and immediately, you know, caused, it was implicated in the French Revolution, later in the Turkish and Russian revolutions, had brought misfortune to various owners, divorce, bankruptcy, and death. And so it was a very compelling tale. And the person he was telling this to was Evelyn Walsh McLean and her husband Ned McLean. They owned the Washington Post. Good friends of Florence Harding, who was later to become First Lady of the United States. This acquired a certain characteristic at the end of the Gilded Age. It had a lot in common, if you think about it, with the curse of the Titanic. And the curse later, about 10 years later, of the of Tutankhamun. And that is, it resonated with the idea that there was, because of basically disparities of wealth in the United States, and because of the relationship between the West and the East, basically colonialism, that the curse of the diamond was payback. And it was payback for rich folks stealing the money or getting the money from poor folks, or it was payback for the West robbing the East of its treasures. And somehow that resonated at the time. There was a good bit of resentment against folks that, you know, would put diamonds around the necks of their dogs and parade them while other poor people didn't have enough to eat or didn't have jobs. And so the curse is, you know, in a sense, it was a made-up story, but it was true in the sense that it resonated with deep-seated feelings, almost, if you will, of class warfare, or the idea that, as one very wealthy American at the time said, you know, God gave me my money. And the idea that appealed to people with the curse is, so you think God gave you your money, wouldn't it be interesting if another God took it away?
We're speaking with Richard Curran about his book called Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem. One thing that we probably need to talk about right off the bat is that what we know now as the Hope Diamond, we think, trace its history all the way back to when and even where this gem was unearthed. But in fact, there is an interruption in that history. The sense I get is that we can't maybe be absolutely certain, but it's a very good probability that the long history that you have traced is of indeed the same gem, which undergoes some alterations over the year. Yeah. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're pretty, you know, we're about 99% sure that we can trace the diamond to its origins. There's a French trader, Jean-Baptiste Tavernier, who goes to India in the 1600s, and pretty sure that he acquires this diamond that was called the Tavernier Violet. He basically held it for a number of years and brought it back to France. But it was 112 carats, and he acquired it in India. And the records of him taking it back, selling it to French King Louis XIV are pretty good. And recent experiments at the Smithsonian pretty much show that our cut-down Hope Diamond, which is now 44 carats, is traceable to a French diamond known as the French Blue that was 67 carats, that's traceable back to this Tavernier Violet diamond that was 112 carats. So the lineage is pretty clear, but again, there's always a little bit of doubt.
When he acquires this first great diamond, it is apparently 112 carats.
Yes.
And maybe we should talk at this moment about what diamonds look like when they come out of the earth. And maybe back then, we're talking about the mid-17th century, even at their best, so to speak, at the most polished, what a diamond would look like back in those days.
Well, you know, I actually tried to, you know, track down, and did, track Tavernier's, you know, footsteps back to the diamond mine, the particular diamond mine at which he acquired this blue diamond that later became the Hope. And, you know, when you're in that area in India, You know, I was looking on the ground to see if something would shine and I could find diamonds in the rough. The truth of the matter is that diamonds don't really shine and sparkle the way we're used to seeing them in diamond rings. They really have to be cut in a certain way to do that. Diamonds in the rough, you know, can very much be taken as quartz or roughly cut glass. And the Indians, when Tavernier discovered this blue diamond, India was really the only source of diamonds known in the world, and particularly big ones. And the Indians classified diamonds as male and female and neuter. They associated diamonds with different gods and castes. And the Indians thought that diamonds were really protection, almost creating a force field against bad effects. And so they did not cut them in geometric ways that we later did in Europe. So diamonds in the rough are a far cry from what we see on people's rings. Mm.
This diamond trade with which Tavernier was a participant was actually part of an even wider scope form of commerce, which he was also part of what you call mercantile globalism, and especially a trafficking transcontinentally in luxury goods of all kinds. Although we get the sense that diamonds were something sort of exceptionally special in this field.
Well, yeah, and, you know, it's remarkable. We're used to globalization now where we think of products and information going around the globe. But globalization, certainly in this scale and the extensiveness, is rather new. But even going back to the 1600s, you had people like Tavernier, who there he is in India and in Ceylon at the time, and he's saying, you know, the price of those South African emeralds are depressing, you know, the luxury stone market in India. So here he is in the 1600s worrying about South African emeralds undercutting the price of emeralds from Ceylon. I mean, it's amazing.
Wow.
And
thinking,
you know,
about the world in those terms that long ago.
Yeah, and you know, again, one of the things that he had to do is think about the notion of how you recorded the weight, the size and the value of diamonds, because diamonds were implicated in, you know, exchange rates. How many francs for a diamond in Indian rupees and Indian currency? And so all these calculations that we're used to looking at exchange rates in the financial pages of our newspapers or on the net, you had Tavernier and other traders having to do that on the spot as they're moving from culture to culture. How many pearls for how many diamonds and so on.
I especially enjoyed your description of a typical transaction in Golconda, the legendary city of, is it a city of gold or city of...
City of diamonds. That was really the trade area, yeah.
Yes. And describe to our listeners, a buyer and seller sitting across from each other, how a transaction would be done.
Well, typically, if Tavernier came into the market in Golconda, which was the name of the capital city where the diamonds, most of the diamond mines were, and you would sit down, the diamond seller would put these diamonds on basically a black rock set in the ground and display a diamond. And then basically these two guys, the buyer and the seller, would stick their hands under the sleeve of each other and use their fingers as code so that other people would not see the price. And they'd use, you know, kind of one finger or a squeeze at the elbow, and that would mean 1,000 rupees. They'd use fingers on their wrists or hands. And so they use this intricate code to negotiate diamonds so other people would not know the exact price they were paying. You can think of that almost like what happens in the New York Stock Exchange or in the commodity markets today, where if you're looking from the outside, you have all sorts of people using hand signals and other things to negotiate and to trade stocks. And if you're an outsider, you have no idea what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Something else you mentioned in this early chapter is the way in which the Indians viewed these kind of precious gems. You talk about how they saw them as possessing sort of special powers of strength and protection, that kings and queens needed gems to help them rule effectively and not be overcome by evil forces. So for them, it was not a matter of ostentation, of wearing a gem because it shows how rich you are. It had nothing to do with that, or not much to do with that.
Yeah, as one you know, jeweler, you know, told me in an interview, these gems were used by Indian gods, goddesses, kings, and queens as almost protection. The idea is that gems, shiny rocks found in the earth, actually are bits of fallen stars and planets from above. And when you wear them, they basically have the power almost to suck in bad stuff and absorb it. And so it's almost a protection. It's almost an amulet of protection against bad stuff in the universe. And, of course, gods that are called the Shining Ones, and kings and queens often take on that appellation too, the idea is that it sucks in the bad stuff and shines out the good stuff. Think of it as almost a Pandora's box that absorbs all the evil and all the bad stuff in society. And, of course, I think what happens with the thinking about the curse is as gems travel back to the West, what do people in the West do? Well, during the Renaissance, they develop a sense of optics. They develop a sense of light coming out. And so they start cutting these diamonds in very geometric ways that the stuff shines out. And so all the bad stuff accumulated in these gems in the East is all of a sudden let out, and it shines in the West. And I think that's the kind of underlying logic of the curse. When you read about things in by the 20th century in the United States and in Europe, the idea is that these gems from India have baleful and woeful influences. There's a light inside that's let loose on society. And so the Pandora's box of all the evils that have accumulated in the East are then let loose in the West. And I think that's the underlying logic of the curse.
One other thing which I thought was kind of interesting, as you mentioned, the value placed on diamonds by various cultures. I remember you writing about the Romans and how they also valued diamonds, but not for the reason that the Indians did and not in the way that Europeans later did, but just the fact that they so admired admired diamonds for their strength, for the fact that they were such a tremendously hard, unyielding surface.
Well, I think people discovered that early on, that diamonds were very rare because they were so hard. And the Romans actually, you know, did, because they were getting diamonds from India, and I think they were attuned to one of the Indian uses of diamonds, did not cut them either. Because the cutting of diamonds really doesn't get started till the Renaissance. So the Romans also used these diamonds as protections from the evil eye, you know, and the idea that I think they provided some protection. And we know through the Middle Ages, diamonds really weren't cut in Europe. It was really the Renaissance where people applied the sense of optics and light. And the notion of enlightened rulers and rulers standing for the sun. You think of Louis XIV as the Sun King, and the idea, you know, let these diamonds shine just like my kingdom shines, like my presence shines. So,
of course, things don't turn out quite so well for instance, Marie Antoinette and others associated with the Hope Diamond, which raises another question for you as a historian. When we are talking about, first of all, such a long history told and retold by so many people, how does one pick between the facts and the fiction, between the real history and the stuff of legend? Tell us about that challenge for you in trying to come to a better understanding of this long history.
Well, that's why it took me 13 years to write the book. and I hope that 13 doesn't have any bad luck associated with it. But it took a lot. I mean, I had to travel to India several times, really looking through archives and records in France, in Russia, in Switzerland, in England, even in the dusty old archives of the attic of the Smithsonian, to really try to get a handle on separating out truth from fiction. And as you pointed out, you know, this did become instant folklore, and if you go on the web or you go to these other things, sometimes things are repeated so much that they seem to take on a life of their own. And the Hope Diamond, in some respects, was a very early, what we call urban legend. And it really acquired its power because things were associated printed in the newspapers, subject of film and documentary films and so on, and I really had to get down to primary sources, primary records, scientific evidence, and so on. And while there's still some speculation And I end the book with a series of 21 questions about things that have to be examined even further. And there may be your listeners out there that have pieces of information or access to it that will help us on that treasure hunt for the real facts. Nevertheless, it really requires tracking down the leads, almost like a history detective.
Hmm. And maybe some of these questions at some point will be answered. That list is very fascinating, as is an appendix which gives us a concise timeline, and another appendix which gives us some of the prices are paid for the Hope Diamond or some of the appraisals made for it, which right now must be absolutely through the roof.
Well, I dare say it's probably more than your salary and mine combined. The last reasonable appraisal of the Hope Diamond, done by Ronald Winston, who's the son of Harry Winston, who donated the gem to the Smithsonian in 1958, was for about $200 million.
Hmm.
Now, if you had a diamond that was just a plain, 45-carat blue diamond, it would be very rare. And it would probably go anywhere from about $600,000 to maybe $1 million a carat. So the Hope Diamond could very well, be worth about $30 to $45 million, just as a plain blue diamond. But when you add all the story, all the legend, all the myth, that 350 years of history, the story adds about another $150 million to the price. So it's a very, very valuable diamond.
Richard Curran's book is Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem, a Smithsonian book published by HarperCollins. Richard Curran, this is a fascinating book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today on the morning show. My thanks to you.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you.